Is there a pointer or a stick of some kind?
Should be.
All right. It's a beautiful day in Davis, as I'm sure it usually is, and I'm happy to be here. This is some work that I've been doing with Chris Hill, and there's a few other things in progress. This appeared in January. Just to start, questions of phenomenology, which I'm sure most or all of you are very familiar with. Does a Higgs boson exist? We don't know, but precision measurements are consistent with something that looks like a standard monoelectric sector with a scalar Higgs field, say less than 200 GeV. And the Higgs field gives an economical, if not very insightful, description of fermion masses. Question two, is electric symmetry broken by fermions condensing? Why is this a reasonable thing to ask? Well, so far, except for gravity, all the things that we observe in the standard model follow the pattern of spin-half fermions interacting by exchanging spin-1 gauge fields. And it's reasonable to ask if that is what we're going to continue to see in the next few years. And notice also that electric symmetry is or would be broken in a standard model without a Higgs field, only that would happen down at a scale of a GeV and not 100 GeV, since the weak interactions are coupled to left-handed quarks but not to right-handed quarks. Electric symmetry would be broken when fermions condense at the strong scale. Question one plus two, combine those questions and take the good points of both of them. We notice that composite particles like pions, kaons, and eta can be naturally light compared to the scale of other new physics. This could explain why we don't see much else so far below a TeV scale through indirect measurements. If this isn't the most exciting scenario, then it's at least not preposterous. It's not ruled out, and it would be embarrassing if something like this were going on, but we missed it. And so we should figure out what the signals are for such a scenario. So to motivate a composite scenario, we can start at the top down. We can go bottom up. Suppose we start at some very high scale. Say we had something like extended technicolor. I don't want to specify anything as specific as technicolor, so let's just call it supercolor for some unspecified theory. These might give you some four-quark operators down here that would eventually generate masses when something condensed at this scale. The question is, how do we explain a large separation between the scale of fermion condensation and the weak scale? So this is the problem of a typical technicolor model, that if electroweak interactions are broken by a QCD condensate, why don't we see a whole bunch of other stuff at the weak scale? And we can alleviate that concern by saying that condensation actually happens out here, and something like a Higgs field, a pion, a kaon, leaks down to the weak scale and finally breaks electroweak symmetry. Or if you don't believe in all of that, just say, suppose eventually, experimentally, we see something that looks like a multiple of NGBs, one of which is a Higgs, or acts as a Higgs in the standard model. What else should we see? What else should we see, and how do we understand that multiple of NGBs? So that then brings me to the two-part outline of the talk. The first, questions of theory. What is the most general four-dimensional effect of Lagrangian describing NGBs of a broken symmetry? And this is logically distinct from another question, but deeply related to that question, and that is, what is the Lorentzian description of a theory of strongly coupled fermions? And we can see that we can answer almost all questions without ever talking about fermions, but there is a natural fermion interpretation. So the outline then is just to look at a simple Wessel-Meno term for a simple little Higgs model, an SU3 mod SU2 model. I'll talk a little bit more about anomalies in Wessel-Meno-Witten terms, some implications for little Higgs theories, implications for T parity, and then a bit of theoretical playing with planar equivalences. So a simple model We want some spontaneously broken symmetry of a group G broken down to a group H. We want H to contain electroweak interactions, so it has to be at least SU2. 3 is the smallest thing bigger than 2, so let's try SU3 mod SU2. Which SU2 is unbroken? Let's start with SU3 in the Galvan matrices. We took, for instance, this SU2 subgroup. The 5 broken generators don't range into doublet and singlet. So let's try these instead. Take the lambda 1, 2, 3 SU2 subgroup. The NGBs from that spontaneously broken symmetry form a doublet and a singlet. The doublet we want to identify with the Higgs. Okay, so let me just remind you effective actions for NGBs. We have a field space. That field space corresponds to all the flat directions of degenerate vacua. Okay, so the way that we can build that field space, being a little bit pedantic, is we start with some point, call that a vacuum. We can generate another vacuum by acting with a general group element, okay, so just rotate about the vertical axis. And if all the generators are broken, then our field manifold of vacuum states just corresponds to all of the elements we get by acting with a general group element on any chosen vacuum. If some generators are not broken, okay, so this would be the case if we looked at the surface of a sphere and took one point on the surface of the sphere, rotations about that point are not broken generators. And so we define our field space as, again, everything that we can get by acting with the general group element, but we get the same thing if we first act with one of the unbroken group. So the actual field space is a coset space. Examples of this are SU3 cross SU3 broken to SU3, as in the three-quark chiral Lagrangian for QCD. Another example is this SU3 mod SU2, and we'll see that that's equivalent to a field space, which is a five-dimensional unit sphere. In more detail, if we choose one point, call that our vacuum, then a general vacuum state is gotten by rotating with respect to this matrix. And we identify that column vector with points in our field space, then our field space is just a set of phi complex three vectors such that phi dag or phi equals one. And this is the five-dimensional unit sphere sitting in 6 dimensions. We're going to identify the unbroken group with electroweak interactions. And now the Higgs and the eta as the Goldstone bosons. And now we ask what is the most general action for the dynamics of W, H, and eta, given that these are Goldstone bosons. So the first constraint is that they have to be electroweak gauge invariant. And so we'd have a whole slew of operators. But actually, this is a bit too generous. There are further constraints from symmetry. We know that these have to be written in terms of phi in order to obey the global chiral symmetry. And so we can go along and write down the most general SU3 invariant action in terms of covariant derivatives. Okay, let me just drop the gauge fields for a moment and write the ungauged action in this form. And we can ask, is that the most general thing we can write down? Not quite. There's exactly one other thing that we missed. And that other thing, we'll see that we can write down another action that has all the correct invariance properties. And now this is an exact statement. The action is given by a number times the area bounded by the integer spacetime on the field manifold S5. And I'll explain that in a minute. Together, these two give the general effective action for phi, and that's the solution to our problem. So what do I mean by this gamma prime of phi? I want to emphasize this isn't anything subtle. This is just another way of building a local four-dimensional SU3 invariant action. And if back in the 60s or 70s, we hadn't gotten caught up in fermions, and we really had to write down actions in terms of pions and so on, then this would just be page 2 of a quantum field theory text. we have to write down the most general action, and this is one way of doing it. So let me represent space-time by a circle. X is some point in space-time. The mapping X goes to 5X is a mapping of space-time onto this manifold. And the prescription is do that mapping and take the area bounded by that by the map. Okay. Explicitly, the area form of the phi sphere is this. It's a conveniently chosen normalization, as I'll show in a minute. And so our action is just some number times that area. We can actually say more about that number from the fact that this has to be consistent whether we choose the inside or the outside. We don't know a priori which we should choose, and the only way that this can give a consistent answer is if the difference between the two choices is equal to 2 pi times an integer. So e to the I action is the same. Okay, so the volume of S phi is pi cubed, and that means that our action is this thing. It's quantized with an integer, then 2 pi times something that integrates to 1 over the whole sphere. So that's our action. And this action is quantized, and we can tell that it's distinct from the other terms by the fact that it's odd in space-time. Okay, so it has odd space parity, and these five boson interactions, even in QCD, are difficult to observe, but it's easier to see this physics if we couple gauge fields to the system. So that's what I'm going to do now. We haven't seen five boson interactions in QCD, but we have seen things like pi and octagamma gamma. I need to introduce a bit of mathematical jargon. Actually, I don't need to introduce it, but since some people might have heard these words before, I just want to mention how it ties in. There's a topological index, the mappings of four spheres into the manifold, and the fact that pi 4 of S5 equals 0 tells us that for any bounding surface, any curve, there is a bounding surface with that curve as its boundary. And the fact that pi 5 of this manifold is z tells us that if we choose different bounding surfaces, that we get something consistent up to multiples of an integer. These are, in fact, obvious once you know what is the definition of these things. These are really just definitions. For things like SUN, it's not as obvious that these things hold. And that's why, in this case, the topology is a bit complicated. The algebra turns out to be almost trivial because of the additional symmetry in the problem. Here, the topology is trivial. The algebra is a little more complicated. Okay, so how do you gauge this thing? Just to emphasize that it's nothing sophisticated. Suppose we try to gauge the kinetic term in the Lagrangian. Okay, so this is almost I don't want to offend. Just emphasize that there's nothing funny going on. If we were to take a gauge variation of this phi field, phi goes to e to the I epsilon phi. This thing is invariant because the derivative hits the epsilon. Okay, but we can make it gauge invariant, or try to, by adding a gauge field that has a compensating gauge variation. A goes to A plus d epsilon. Okay, so the total gauge variation now contains mixed derivatives and gauge fields, and we can finally add another term. Adding that term, 0, 1, and 2, we finally get 0. Okay, and that is why we write down gauge covariant derivatives, so we don't have to go through all this business every time we write down a simple scalar field theory. Okay, now we can do the same game with our quantized topological action. So this is the analog of the ungauged kinetic term. Okay, now just take a gauge variation. Now recall that this thing is an integral over a five-dimensional manifold. Everything here is in form notation, and so there's really epsilon symbols that have been suppressed. There's no apologies for forms because this whole business is in terms of hypersurfaces in higher dimensional spaces. Differential forms are hypersurfaces, so it's guaranteed that such things are going to appear. Now, the gauge variation of this thing, we want to be able to add four-dimensional gauge fields to make this thing gauge invariant. The only way that can be the case is if this gauge variation is a total derivative. So using Stokes' theorem, we get something four-dimensional. Now, unfortunately, this is a total derivative, but there's another thing here that makes it look like it's not a total derivative. So the only way this can work is if this thing is zero. But that thing is zero by a non-trivial identity relating the Gell-Helm matrices to these complex three vectors representing the phi sphere. And using that identity, we're left with something four-dimensional. And now we can continue to play our game and add gauge fields. We first of all need to notice that this thing doesn't look globally invariant. It has an epsilon. We want it to be globally invariant, which means it has to be a d epsilon. We know that we constructed this action in such a way that it was automatically globally invariant, so something has to happen, and what happens is that we have another non-trivial identity, and using that identity here, we finally do get something that is local. Epsilon only appears with d epsilon, and so we can compensate that gauge variation with a gauge field. Okay, so we can continue on that way. We add 1, 2, 3, 4 gauge fields, and the action finally ranges into a set of unquantized gauge invariant operators plus a quantized action, and that quantized action is not gauge invariant, but its gauge variation is independent of the Meson fields. Okay, and that fact means that we can identify that gauge variation with a fermion anomaly, and so we can look for a fermionic theory that results in that spontaneous symmetry breaking. And if we recall the generic form of a fermion anomaly for some set of left-handed fermions and right-handed fermions, then we can recognize exactly what fermion content could have given rise to this symmetry pattern. And that fermion content is the following. It's a triplet of left-handed fermions and a single right-handed fermion. And rather interestingly, it turns out that this can only be consistent if the number of colors is even. Okay, so now we've completed our tour of quantizing our topological action, and now we can just read off the various interactions of gauge fields and NGBs. For instance, interactions similar to pi naught to gamma gamma in the QCD Carle-Lagrangian. To do this in practice actually requires a bit of heavy machinery. So for anyone mathematically minded, let me just mention a few of those things. This is really implementing the ideas of global chiral symmetry and four-dimensionality that we knew have to be there from the start. And we need to see those in intermediate steps. And what we need to implement that is some mathematical identity between Lie derivatives, so-called inner derivatives or inner products, and the exterior derivatives. And so when we took the gauge variation of our action, we got something that looked D of something, which was going to integrate by Stokes' theorem to give us something four-dimensional, but there's some remainder term. And the reason that remainder term is zero is because the Lie derivative is zero. That's just the statement that it's globally invariant. And the fact that d omega is zero, the fact that omega is closed. And this was a five-form in a five-dimensional space, so that's why it was closed. And that's how we make the action manifestly four-dimensional as it had to be. And we can play a similar game to make the action manifestly local as it has to be. So this inner product, again, by the identity between various derivatives, the Lie derivative of the form is zero since it's globally invariant, and the form is closed since it's five form in a five-dimensional space. And again, we get something that's local and so can be compensated by a four-dimensional gauge field. We can continue, and actually using these methods always show that by adding more and more gauge fields, we can make an action that's independent of Meson fields, and that's a non-trivial statement. that if we take a gauge variation of this thing that depends on pions, we get something that doesn't depend on pions. By definition, this is a consistent anomaly, so there's a lot of leftover jargon from before I was around, working in terms of currents. It's never obvious whether a current, an anomaly actually makes sense, but everything I'll talk about here is a consistent anomaly. Since it's a gauge variation of a well-defined action, all we need to know is that that is a consistent anomaly. So this can be formalized into an easy but important theorem. We call it the fermions theorem. If we have NGBs from some spontaneously broken continuous symmetry, if it's possible to write down a topological action, then the symmetry breaking has a chiral fermion interpretation. When I say it has a chiral fermion interpretation, there's a set of fermions that gives the same anomalous variation as this theory. Whether or not those fermions can be shown to condense in the same way that whether or not QCD can be shown to break chiral symmetry is a whole other problem.
Isn't there more than one fermion interpretation?
I will talk about that interesting question.
So I have another question. I mean, in some sense, your construction leads to this global term plus the usual minimal action, gauge invariant action. But it's always, in general, possible to go beyond and then write down other terms that are not of the minimal gauge invariant form. Is that not the case here? Is it until you can never?
There are going to be so-called Gasser-Lloyd-Wheeler operators and things of that nature. I'm not sure if
right,
those are
right.
Yeah,
I mean, these are things that would normally be generated at loop order, but if you're just doing something in general, you could throw them in at tree level.
Is there something forbidding
doing it at tree level? Or is it just a choice?
I'm not sure which operators
you
need at tree level.
You already have high dimension operators.
So there's going to be arranged
in a certain way, though, right?
There's going to be a kinetic term that appears there with two derivatives. This term and a whole bunch of other stuff will appear with four derivatives.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be a whole bunch of other stuff appearing with six derivatives and so on.
Right, but they'll have a certain arrangement, won't they?
This so-called Wessel-Meinl term is the only one that is quantized, if that is the question. All of the other ones a priori, I mean, once you know the fermion theory, you can match and then find out what the coefficients are of those operators, but a priori, you don't know anything else.
I guess that's
them.
My question. So there are a whole bunch of operators that are perfectly gauge invariant, but you don't necessarily know their relative coefficients without specifying the fermion theory. Is that what you're
That's
saying?
Right.
Okay.
So
I understand. Okay.
You have to look at special processes in order to access this one, and there are special processes like pi naught to gamma gamma.
Right.
So this special term, what we need to write this special term, is a closed globally invariant phi form, and pardon my English. So an example is SU3 mod SU2. This was a phi form on a phi manifold, and that is automatically closed. Another example is any theory with a parity defined on symmetry generators, or if you like, a symmetric space. Symmetric V algebra. In that case, we can also write this closed globally invariant phi form. And once we can do that, we can write down this topological action, then we can take the gauge variation of that topological action and apply this reasoning.
Can you remind me of the mathematical definition of closed?
This is the sense in which. These sorts of so div curl equals zero is one aspect of form being closed, which means that it's a total derivative, and then means that it's a total derivative.
Okay.
total derivative. So that's closed. Something that is exact is automatically closed because d acting on something is zero.
Mm-hmm.
But if something is closed, it's not necessarily exact if there's a non-trivial topology in the space. Okay, so what do I mean when I say parity defined on the algebra here? If I want to define some analog of vector and axial in a general Lie algebra, then it has to be the case that the commutation relations of that algebra are of this form. So if I take b to plus b, a to minus a, then those relations are still preserved. And examples where this is the case are the usual chiral Lagrangian, the vector generators are the generators of SUN, the axial generators have a gamma phi. Another example is SUN mod SON, for instance, in SU3 mod SO3, if I take 2, 5, and 7 Gell-Mann matrices as the vector and the other ones as axial, then these relations are satisfied. SUN mod SPN, for n even, is another example. And a non-example was our simple SU3 mod SU2 model, where lambda equals 1, 2, 3, lambda 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, don't satisfy that. And so it's the special reason that the field space is five-dimensional that allowed us to write the topological action in that case. If we don't write that topological action, then at first sight it looks like the effective action conserves this internal parity. The kinetic term, or any other thing that we can obviously write down in terms of covariant derivatives and the chiral matrix field, this would forbid interactions that have odd numbers of NGPs and vector fields, like pi naught to gamma gamma. The left side is odd under this parity, the right-hand side is even. However, this action has no anomalous gauge variation, and that's not the case if we couple a QCD to a general background gauge field. We know there's a limit to how many gauge fields we can couple to a system of fermions before we get anomalies. So this action has too much symmetry and not enough anomaly, we could say. And so it's almost a paradoxical fact that whenever a parity can be defined, we can construct a term in the action that breaks that parity. And how do we do that? So this is how to construct that that topological action when we have a parity. So first we call SUN cross SUN mod SUN. This is just like before, but it's harder to visualize. And here, this sentence is not exactly area bounded by the image of spacetime in SUN. Well, it is the area where area means the integral over a certain phi form. That phi form is defined by this chiral current. That chiral current is defined in terms of our chiral matrix field. Okay, so this then is the action. And this construction is allowed by these topological features of the SUN manifold, as noticed by Witten sometime in the 80s. Quantization condition is again necessary for consistency. We don't know, just given this curve, if we should take the area here or the area out here, and so we have to get the same answer up to 2 pi no matter which one we choose.
Right. So what's the five manifold you're reading over?
It's any five manifold which is a bounding surface of the image of spacetime. So the whole space is an eight-dimensional manifold now.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing here, pi 4 of SU3, for instance, equals 0, says that if you have any curve and you take any point on the manifold, you can shrink that curve down to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And the surface you get by doing that shrinking defines the 5 manifold.
Okay.
And now the action is that integral over that manifold. Now, the fact that this thing is an integer says that any other bounding surface that you took would essentially be wrapping around a sphere some number of times. So that you always get that thing plus 2 pi times an integer.
Is there a simple way to see where 240 comes from?
240. I can tell you where the, well, there's a factor of 5 that is related to that 5, and I'll let you take care of the other factors. But it's just, it's the normalization of the, I can just give you a useless mathematical jargon, but it's just the normalization of the generator of the Durand cohomology group on SU3. There's a 1 over 48 pi squared in that normalization for any SUN group. I don't have much more to say on that. I think if you ask Witten, he'll say it has something to do with the Bott periodicity theorem, but these things all have something to do with each other. It's the analog of the pi cubed that came with the normalization for. I can give you the pi squared. The pi squared is 2 pi times 1 over pi cubed. Mm-hmm. So that takes care of the 5 and the pi. There's a 3 there that, well, 3s and 2s are left for you. So suppose that the NGBs, now in a general case, can be collected into a unitary matrix so that the unitary matrix transforms in this way. A general chiral rotation takes U to something on the left, something on the right. This was, for example, the case for SUN cross SUN broken to SUN, where we take a general SUN matrix here and a general SUN matrix here. Okay, but in general, as long as that's true, it follows that we can write a closed field invariant phi form. We can write our alpha is just du times u dagger, as we did before, and then we can take trace of alpha to the fifth. That defines our phi form. And this was the mathematical ingredient we needed with our fermions without fermions theorem. We needed a closed global invariant phi form. And now, in fact, this is the case that we have a U that transforms in that specified way for a general symmetry breaking pattern with a parity. And the reason that is true is that we can always put it into the form of this so-called nonlinear realization, as these people showed. Okay, so if this is e to the I pi is our chiral field, then a general representation can be written as something acting on the left. Okay, in general, e to the I epsilon, e to the I pi isn't going to give us e to the I broken generators, but it's going to be all mixed up. But if we rotate back by some function of epsilon and pi, then we can get back to something that is e to the I broken generators. And then we can define e to the I broken generators goes to e to the I broken generators defines pi goes to pi prime. Okay, now it's a bit of a funny way of going about things, but that's the most general way we can always put it into that form. And now we notice that when there's a parity, things get a lot simpler, and that's the point. So pi is on into this parity. This is an unbroken symmetry generator, so that's even. And now if we just take the parity acting on this thing multiplied by parity acting on the inverse of this thing, then we get this simple transformation law for e to the 2i pi prime equals e to the I epsilon e to the 2i pi e to the minus parity acting on epsilon. Okay, so even though e to the I pi has some funny transformation law, e to the 2i pi has a very simple transformation law. And that allows us to write down our topological action. We could actually work directly from this nonlinear realization. If we view this as a restriction of a more general SUN. So in general, not all of the SUN generators up here correspond to broken generators. In general, it's only a subgroup of it. But let's view the case as a restriction of the SUN multiple of NGBs and unconstrained left and right variations. Okay, this has too many NGBs and too many symmetry generators, but these things cancel each other out, and this gets back to the question of how we can find different fermion theories that have the same anomaly. The idea is that we can eat and decouple the extra pions, so we strongly couple an A-right gauge field here in the strong coupling limit that gauge field eats the extra pions and decouples them from the theory. And just in more explicit terms, introduce separate left and right gauge fields. These are the ones we're interested in. This is a new gauge field that we introduce. Take that coupling to infinity, okay, to integrate out that field, solve the equation of motion for A right. You get A right as a function of the NGBs and A left. Plug that back into the action. And now it's an interesting question, what do we get? Okay, so suppose that we started with Carroll Lagrangian that looked like QCD, SU3 cross SU3, broken to SU3. What do we get when we plug this solution for A right and that strong coupling limit back into that? And is it the same as the direct construction starting from SU3 mod SU2, which we did by going through the business in the 5-sphere? Okay, so first, let's turn off the U1 just for simplicity. It's easy to see that these things have the same anomaly, since the SU2 has a vanishing D symbol. This has exactly the same anomaly as what we got when we went through the whole business of gauging the 5-sphere and taking the gauge variation of the final action. It appears here that any even or odd integer is possible, so that would be different from our direct construction because there it had to be an even integer. In fact, the odd is ruled out by a global SU2 anomaly. This is the same thing that says in the standard model we have to have an even number of SU2 doublets for consistency. And since we're gauging a physical A right gauge field, we have to again have an even number of SU2 doublets. So this agrees also in the sense of being an even integer. In a more mundane level, we can compare order by order and pions and get the same answer. We can note that more gauge invariant operators appear in the direct construction than from this nonlinear realization. This is just because the nonlinear realization is more restrictive on the UV completion. From a U, we can always get a phi, but we can't get a phi. From a U, we can get a phi. From a phi, we can't always get a U. But the Wessimino-Witten term is the same. This brings up the question of when two different fermion field theories can be the same. A necessary, not sufficient condition is that if chiral symmetry breaking happens, the resulting Carroll Lagrangians agree. This Wessimino-Witten term and its gauge variation are, in some sense, label of different fermion field theories, and we can check if the labels of those fermion field theories are the same. Okay, so we can ask, if two Carroll Lagrangians generate the same anomaly, are they the same? Given a consistent anomaly, can we recreate the action, is what we're asking. So starting from a consistent anomaly, is there a unique action that we get? You'll notice that this is almost a tautology, because we're saying do two things that have the same gauge variation agree up to gauge invariant operators? And of course that is true, unless something we're doing doesn't make sense. So this is really a check that what we're doing makes sense. So integrating a consistent anomaly, we have some gauge variation of an action. Can we recreate the action that gauge variation came from? Just like we looked at the kinetic term engaging our topological term, let's look at a simpler thing than the topological action in integrating this consistent anomaly. So consider a U1 field coupled to a photon. Evaluate the action at phi equals 1. Okay, I get this action. And now take a local variation of this new action. I get this. The reason for going through all of that is that this is a consistent anomaly. I started with a well-defined action. I took its gauge variation. By definition, this is a consistent anomaly. That's all I wanted. Okay, so the question is, given this consistent anomaly, can we build a boson theory that generates it? And the answer is yes. Essentially, just solve the differential equation, and it is the case that the general solution to that differential equation has this form. We invent a scalar field, call it a pion, we take our gauge field and do a gauge transformation rotated by this pion field, and then we evaluate the anomaly on that rotated gauge field and integrate from 0 to 1. Okay, we do that, we get this answer. If we now add the boundary condition of the action at pi equals 0, then we recover the original action. Okay, so this is just saying that if we have an anomaly, we can integrate it to get the action up to gauge invariant operators. And apply exactly the same reasoning to this anomalous gauge variation of topological action. Okay, so anytime we have some gauge variation which vanishes for A in some subgroup H, we can integrate to get an action for SUN mod H. Okay, so two chiral Lagrangians generate the same anomaly, then the same up to gauge invariant operators. And this demonstrates interesting equivalences between the Wessel-Meidel terms obtained from different unbound fermion theories. One example was SU3 mod SU2. Another example was SU3 squared mod SU3. And in a certain limit, these give exactly the same topological term. Just for the experts in the audience, it might appear that when we integrated things, there wasn't an obvious quantization condition that came in, but we can trace back where the quantization condition came in. And I think I'll leave that till later in case there's questions. Okay, so what does all of this mean for composite or little Higgs models? So we need to find a mechanism for a light Higgs field to leak down below some scale of strong interactions, new strong interactions. That's step one. Step two is then to generate a Higgs potential in coupling the fermions with an upsetting one. So I'll concentrate on one because that's easy. And if we can understand one, we can shed some light on two. Okay, so just in general, there's a notion of collective symmetry breaking, and this is at least one of the new ingredients in so-called little Higgs models versus composite Higgs models. And what's going on here? If we have a general collection of gauge symmetry generators, some unbroken generators, call them V, broken generators, call them A, then we can show that the one loop contribution to scalar masses is this formula. Okay, it's some positive constant times some thing which is positive and non-zero minus some other thing that is positive and non-zero. So the lessons that we can take from this equation are that firstly, if we don't gauge any broken generators and if our NGBs are charged under any of the symmetries, then the masses get a quadratically divergent contribution at one loop. So in order to make this thing zero at one loop, we need to gauge broken generators. And this is the idea of electric symmetry breaking by vacuum misalignment, so-called. The electric symmetric vacuum can be destabilized by gauging broken generators strongly enough. Okay, so if we gauge something over here strongly enough, we can make use of that minus sign and make this thing negative. And we can also use that minus sign to cancel these things exactly to make this a flat potential through one loop order. Okay, so we want to apply these topological interactions to see what we can say about the underlying fermion theory for little Higgs bosons. One reason why it's not easy, okay, so we can recall a case of QCD. It's hard, first of all, because we're looking for symmetry partners of kaons, but we haven't yet seen those symmetry partners, and we haven't yet even seen the kaons. Okay, so we're not even sure what theory we're guessing at. But second of all, these are kaons and not pions. And kaons are harder than pions because single kaon interactions are ruled out by isospin, and two kaon interactions are ruled out by the NGB parity that the Wessel-Meidel term obeys. Okay, so if we're going to look in the QCD chiral Lagrangian and find a topological interaction involving a kaon, something analogous to pi naught to gamma gamma, it's harder, okay, because of these facts. The interactions have to involve either other NGBs, like the high in the eta, or gauge fields for broken generators. Okay, So it's not impossible, but we have to keep this in mind. So two examples of such interactions. Let's take two copies of this SU3 mod SU2, and this is a little Higgs model. If we gauge both copies with the same SU3 gauge field, one copy of the Goldstone bosons is eaten, another copy survives, and now we can just crank through and find the topological interactions involving the Higgs bosons. And this would, for instance, appear in associated production of the Higgs with this heavy isospin half gauge boson. Another example is SU5 mod SO5. Okay, so collect the NGBs into this unitary matrix field. There's some stuff here that's going to be eaten by gauge generators. There's something here that's going to receive a large mass in one loop, and we assume that it can be heavy and integrated out. And what's left is a Higgs at low energy. Since there's a lot of other stuff going on, we have to look at something special in order to isolate the topological interaction, but we can do that. And the most dramatic thing is going to be for anomaly-dominated decays, or so-called decays of lightest T-odd particles in the standard model particles. For instance, either the eta particle here or the gauge boson, the 8 eta, is going to decay into 2 Zs or 2 Ws, or so on. Just a word on something that is missing so far, I think, from little Higgs models. In order to implement this little Higgs mass cancellation, we need to gauge broken generators. Also, if we want to implement this electric symmetry breaking by vacuum misalignment, we need to gauge broken symmetry generators. In general, there's going to be a broken U1 here that is anomalous. Okay, and we can't just gauge anomalous symmetries without doing something else in the theory. Two things that we can do are to cancel with decoupled sectors. Okay, so this is the idea of the Kaplan-Schmaltz SU3 minus SU2 squared model. We gauge two copies of our phi field. This is like a left-right. This is like a right-left condensate. And so gauging those two at the same time cancels anomalies. The other option is to cancel the anomalies with spectators. And so in our SU5 mod SO5 model, we imagine there's something like a lepton sector, which acts like in the standard model to cancel the gauge anomalies. So this adds in another model building issue, which at least for me isn't fully explored. What do we have to say about spectators? Well, one amusing QCD example, suppose we knew the basic structure of the lepton sector. It consists of a doublet and two singlets, but we don't know its coupling to hypercharge. Suppose also that we knew the weak coupling to the meson, but not the number of colors. The program would then be measure the number of colors, be the anomaly, pi naught to gamma gamma, eta to gamma gamma, and so on. We can then deduce the hypercharge couplings of spectator leptons and solve for the hypercharge in terms of NC. Okay, so we can imagine this program being implemented in a little Higgs model. Of course, it's very difficult without having seen any of the NGBs and knowing exactly what symmetry we're investigating. So just to recap as a historical perspective, the idea of a composite Higgs boson or electric symmetry broken by fermion condensation is an old idea. It started with things like Technicolor and other composite models, went through a period of deconstruction in extra dimensions. But the point here is that while it's important to realize that we can work directly from symmetries and not even talk about fermions, that it's important to realize that anomaly physics still comes back in. And so we're not back where we started from, but we are at a point where we have to worry about these anomaly interactions, even if the fermions aren't mentioned by name. Just two more recent things. T-parity, as introduced by Cheng and Lowell, is an interesting symmetry that can explain the smallness of new physics effects. And we can ask, can this be implemented in these models? First, recall in QCD, there's only one parity. There's a parity that takes psi to gamma 0 times psi, interchanging psi left and psi right. And if we also take vector fields to plus vector and axial fields to minus axials, we get an invariance of the action only if we take x goes to minus x as well. This is not the same as in the Cayley-Lagrangian in the absence of the topological term. There, if we take pi to minus pi and gauge fields to plus minus gauge fields, we get an invariant action. Also, if we take x goes to minus x, we get an invariant action. So we appear to have two parities, but there's only one in QCD. The resolution is that there's a Wessonian term that breaks both parities. It's odd under both pi goes to minus pi and x goes to minus x, and preserves only the combination as in QCD. Implication for little Higgs models, generically, we can't use this NGB parity to mark the stability of a Lebesgue particle. There's still the option that maybe p equals zero, so maybe this term is zero. But that's not the case if it's an underlying fermion theory.
So can we just pause for a moment? You're saying that if you have the WZW term, that there is interaction in there that will automatically connect a single T-odd guy to T-even guys? Or
yes.
I guess somehow I'm missing why that's the case. WZW automatically has that kind of interaction.
I mean, simplest way to start is by noticing that the ungauged action has an epsilon symbol, so it's odd under x goes to minus x, and the leading term is something like a phi pi net interaction, which is odd under the NGB parity. So this is this pi d pi to the fourth Wessonian term, which is the leading term that you get in the QCD Cayley-Lagrangian. And this is odd under pi goes to minus pi because there's five of them.
Let's see, so that has this interaction of one T-odd guy?
So it has an interaction involving five T-odd guys. And if now you gauge this action in QCD, you'd end up with pi naught to gamma gamma. So the pi naught is odd.
I see.
The photon is even, for instance.
Okay.
Okay, and this can happen in one of two ways. It can either be from an internal symmetry, like in QCD, so it happens along these lines, or it can happen where a T-parity is defined from interchanging two different sectors, as in this Kaplan-Schmaltz model. So we define a T-parity to be the interchange of phi 1, phi 2 in a Kaplan-Schmaltz model. That would also be broken by anomalies if it's a fermion theory, since if these are truly identical sectors, the anomalies add, they don't subtract. I think for matters of time, I'll just say that, and because it's really off on a tangent, let me just mention that this equivalence between SU3 mod SU2 and the equivalence between SU3 squared mod SU3 can be taken, I think, to another level, and that's just something I'm playing around with. So there's some equivalences that are conjectured to hold between certain supersymmetric theories and certain non-supersymmetric theories, and these can be raised to multi-flavor theories. And when you look at the the topological interactions in these multi-flavor theories that can be mapped onto each other in the same way as this eating and decoupling transformation that I mentioned. So let me just summarize. In the theory side of things, this SU3 mod SU2 example, I think, gives a very simple picture in which to play around with this Wessimino term. A lot of the topological complexity in Wessimino terms is involved with isolating a five-sphere within a more complicated manifold. In this case, the manifold is the five-sphere, which makes life easier. And this leads into some interesting notions of equivalences on different fermions theories. On the phenomenology side of things, a composite Higgs, I believe, is still a benchmark scenario for a non-standard Higgs. I don't think a default model has yet been identified, and I think that's important. Little Higgs versus composite Higgs emphasizes symmetries, but anomaly physics enters regardless. T-parity is broken by anomalies, and I'm interested in this not as a in a destructive way, but rather as a new and interesting way to probe into the UV completion of Little Higgs model. And let me stop there. Thank you.
Let's see, let me just try to summarize myself here. So if P is equal to zero, then you do have a T parity, you do have a stable lightest T odd guy, right? And that's consistent. P equals zero is a consistent theory or not?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you would first have to give an example of a UV theory that had P equals zero.
I see, there isn't a known example. Of a UV completion that does that.
I mean, you can always say it's just a bunch of scalar fields, a linear signal model, but then I don't think it has much, it has explained much if you say that everything is just a bunch of scalar fields.
So has anybody written down a composite model that has P equals zero?
Composite, in the
sense that some strong interactions are responsible for all these scalar fields.
Yes, so if it's a, I mean, if it's a composite model in the usual sense of some fermions condensing,
right,
then this integer will be the number of colors in the strong gauge group, and that number of colors can't be zero.
Can't be zero, right. Okay,
right.
That's where I was headed. So you're saying that you cannot have that kind of picture for the little Higgs and have a truly stable lightest T odd guy.
Not in the models examined so far. If you maybe make enough sectors, each of them invariant, each of them having no anomalies, you might imagine building in something that could be interchanged to give you a parity.
I see.
But in the examples being examined that I've seen so far, that isn't the case.
So have you estimated how big can P get before it destroys what the T parity was supposed to be doing for us?
That is what I want to talk to the expert about.
What do you want?
The models with 1/240 seem pretty safe.
Yeah. So, but I would. Yeah. So I.
You have dark matter. You want dark matter to destroy it immediately. For precision. Electric constraint, I assume it's safe because some of the other loop suppression, that's enough.
My only concern is that if the model has been constructed to have a T parity in it for the purpose of preserving a T parity, that it might be worthwhile going back to the construction of that model to see if it's natural that. So a littlest Higgs model with T parity, I guess, is a model that many people are looking at for phenomenology, and I don't yet know if it's natural to have exactly the fermion content in that model if there isn't an exact T parity. But I think that's another unresolved issue.
Okay.
but an interesting issue. I really want to emphasize this is a route into the ultraviolet, that these things are, you know, supernatural relations that survive a low energy that probe the UV completion. And so it would be very nice if there is something like an approximate T parity that would make these signals observable.
If you have light composite fermions as well as NGBs, then can't P be zero? The light composite fermions carry the anomaly.
I don't think so. I mean, I think you're just going to get two integers that have to be individually zero, not something that's canceling.
Anomalies match between the composite fermions and the elementary fermions.
But then you would have chiral symmetries for these fermions and chiral symmetries for those ones, and that just means there's many more chiral symmetries that have to be represented in the low energy theory.
No, it's the same chiral symmetry. They're made out of those other fermions.
I mean, if you had two copies of QCD.
No, just one QCD with composite massless fermions. QCD-like theory. Composite fermions. If their anomaly matches the elementary anomaly, then the Wessel-Meno term vanishes.
I don't think so. I think it would be sort of the case that, like in this example, where the anomalies were canceled against the two sectors, and it's... the idea is that you have to introduce, I mean, you have to gauge symmetries that are not anomalous and do cancel, but there are going to be a bunch more other symmetries that you're not allowed to gauge which are anomalous. And since the fermion theory has those anomalous symmetries in it, they have to be represented in the low energy theory. And so that
they're represented by the massless, the anomalies of the massless composite fermions.
If you could show me an example where that is the case, I guess it'd be interesting.
Show you theories where the anomalies match, whether they actually condense, nobody could tell you.
Make
up something.
You're saying that the gauge anomalies cancel between two sectors.
This was Atuf's original program for anomaly matching, right? That to have massless composite fermions, if chiral symmetries were unbroken, then the anomalies would match between the composites and the elementaries. So the question is, since we don't know how to construct those theories, but we can imagine them, we can also imagine theories where there's some chiral symmetries are broken and there are massless composite fermions. And then how much of the anomalies carried by the Wessel-Meno term depends on how much is carried by the massless composite fermions.
Yes. We just have to look in a specific model and see how many chiral symmetries there are in the starting theory, and I mean, you have to match all of those chiral symmetries in the low energy theory.
There's lots of examples of that.
I have to see one example.
Whole field called cyborg duality, where they have millions of theories where massless composite fermions match the anomalies.
So if you can construct a theory that has I'm not sure what the question is anymore. If you're saying you can construct a theory that has effectively P equals zero, then I guess that would be very interesting.
I can make up a low energy spectrum where P will have to be zero. Whether that spectrum actually emerges from the dynamics, you'd have to solve some non-perturbative gauge theory to find out, which I can't do.
So you're saying a UV theory exists, but we don't know what it is.
Well, we can write down a UV theory, and we can write down a low-energy theory that matches the anomalies with P equals zero.
I would like to see the UV theory.